I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Another stock that we're watching today is a Disney. Shares are up by about 0.6% after Bob Iger prevailed yesterday in the shareholder vote meeting. Geetha Ranganathan, Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst on U.S. Media, is standing by for us. Geetha, what did we learn yesterday about Disney and Mr. Iger?
Yeah, definitely a huge sigh of relief for, you know, both Bob Iger and the management team. I mean, it would have been, I think, a very, very publicly embarrassing thing for him if Peltz had won. So this is definitely, I think, gives them something to cheer about, at least in the near term. But other than that, Alex, I think it's really business as usual, right? They have their work cut out for them. They know exactly what they need to do, whether it's finding a proper, good ESPN digital strategy, whether it's getting the streaming business to profits, and more importantly for the board, whether it's chalking out a really bulletproof succession plan this time around.
And on that succession plan, is the expectation, Geetha, that they will hire from within, or will they try to make a big splash by hiring an outsider? How do you think Disney would like to proceed?
Disney has always kind of looked within, Paul, and you know this well. I mean, the last time that they went external was back in 1984. That's when they hired Eisner. You know, Michael Eisner, right, the Barry Diller protege. But after that, it's always been internal, right, whether it's Bob Iger. I mean, it was Bob Iger after that for almost 15 years. And then, of course, you had Bob Chapek for a couple of years. And then, you know, we have Bob Iger 2.0. back again. So they've always kind of had, you know, more, they've always looked internal, and they do have four solid candidates. So all the division chiefs kind of emerging as potential successor candidates. It's just going to be up to how they groom them. Is Bob Iger going to do something very similar to what he did with, you know, Tom Staggs and Jay Rizzullo, kind of have that COO position for somebody whom he's kind of looking to elevate?
What's the time frame here, Geetha, for this?
It has to happen pretty quickly, Alex. I mean, Bob Iger's term, which was initially when he came back in November 2022, was supposed to be 2 years. They extended that out to 4 years. So we have until the end of 2026.
Okay. And he's been known to extend.
Yeah.
And he could do that because most shareholders are like, Bob Iger's better than anybody else out there. We'll stick with that. All right. So, Geetha, things seem to be settling down, a little bit of stability returning to Mickey Mouse. How about at Paramount Global? It's almost the opposite there. The stock is down 6.6%. Are they going to sell the entire company, parts of the company, super voting stock? What's going on there?
Yeah, so it looks like now they have, or they've entered this period of exclusive talks with Skydance Media. And Skydance Media has kind of been, you know, this on again, off again, interested party in the Paramount company. But of course, they didn't want to come out with a bid for the entire company, at least up until this point. They always kind of wanted to do it in a slightly different way by kind of taking control of the voting stock through National Amusements and the Redstone family. Now it looks like they're kind of going to engineer like a two-step process where they first take control of National Amusements and then go about and merge Skydance with the entire company, with Paramount. So still, I mean, there's just more unknowns than knowns at this point. There seems to be some report out there suggesting that they would need to do an equity deal raise of at least $3 billion. That's going to be really dilutive for the current shareholders. Again, we don't know exactly how much Sherry Redstone is demanding for her voting stock. There are rumors out there suggesting it's upwards of about $2 to $2.5 billion. She also owns about close to almost $1 billion in economic stake in Paramount. So again, too many unknowns right now, Paul. But you know, we do definitely have concrete talks. That much is for sure.
So is the Apollo thing like off the table, right? Because that would be more of a piecemeal approach to Paramount, right? Even though the cash deal was better.
So the Apollo thing was actually, initially it was piecemeal, but they only were really interested in the film studio. They did not want the TV networks. They did not want the streaming asset. But it looks like yesterday, when reports emerged about the Skydance deal, they said that Apollo actually had made a $26 billion offer, an all-cash deal for the entire company, which Sherry Redstone, for some reason, basically said no to.
Wow, because I'm looking at the enterprise value today, about $23 billion, so it would have been a little bit of a premium there. And boy, you know who looks smart is the guys at News Corp. I mean, selling their company, several years ago, just the Murdochs, they look kind of smart here. So what's the future? I mean, this is the Paramount studio, Geetha. This is one of the prize jewels in Hollywood. I mean, what happens to this company? I mean, is it going to remain a public traded company? Is it going to be taken private? What's this? What's the most likely outcome?
I think the most likely outcome at this point, Paul, is that it still very much remains a public company. You know, we know that David Ellison is really only interested in the studio portion of the business. And you're absolutely right. It's an iconic studio. There's no doubt about it. They have a very, very valuable studio lot right in the heart of LA. That's worth maybe upwards of $1.5, $2 billion. So obviously there's a lot of assets that he likes, but only with the studio business. So again, the question is, yes, he can keep it a public company, but he might really kind of trim it down, try and find some buyers for the TV network, for probably the streaming platform, and just make this like a pure play kind of a film studio with, you know, production and licensing operations, very similar to like what Lionsgate is doing.
Mm-hmm. Would that command a valuation, like a good valuation for that, if they did that?
So we do know that Apollo came out with $11 billion offer. That's a pretty decent, it's about a 13.5 times EBITDA valuation, which is pretty much in line with where other, you know, pure play studios are trading. So probably, yes, somewhere in that range.
All right, we got you here. Let's ask you about Warner Brothers Discovery, off another 1% today, off 24% this year, down 43% over the last year. Any scenario there that is worth kind of looking at?
I mean, it's been all doom and gloom at Warner Brothers. And really the one metric I think that people are like fixated on for Warner Brothers is EBITDA. You know that when the deal actually went through, or when they were looking to merge those two companies, they spoke about $14 billion in EBITDA. This year, probably we're not even going to hit $10 billion. And that's really why investors are so upset. Combine that with over $40 billion in debt, and that's a recipe for, you know, the doom and gloom. And that's exactly what's happening there. So until we kind of get some better metrics, it's not going to look good.
You know who bailed on the media industry at the right time?
You?
Me.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I am going to see Dune 2.
Well, you're kind of
weekend.
In it right now.
Yeah, I'm kind of in it, but my livelihood, well, it does kind of, I don't know, but, you know, it just.
This is an excellent point.
Yeah.
This is an excellent point, John Tucker, that you just went from the other side of the media business.
Exactly.
I'm seeing Dune 2 on Saturday, so I feel like I'm doing my part.
Dune 2? Okay,
that's right.
Good.
I'm doing
excellent
my part for Warner
movie.
Brothers.
Excellent movie. Some Geetha,
oh,
she
good.
Knows.
Excellent.
See, she
excellent
knows.
Movie. It is absolutely brilliant.
I like right. Paramount Plus because of the whole Survivor thing, because yep. I'm addicted to Survivor. So, you know, I'm helping. I'm doing
okay,
what I
okay.
need to do.
All right, Geetha, thanks so much. As always, Geetha Raghunathan, she covers all the media stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence based down in Princeton.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's stay with energy for a moment. So Green Plains is basically an ethanol company producer that wants to become an ag tech company. And the CEO is taking this very seriously and doing a lot in the middle of this transition. The stock is down, though, 23% in the last year. It is up about 2% today. And we welcome the CEO and president, Todd Becker. He joins us now from Omaha, Nebraska. Todd, it's always good to talk to you. What I love about talking to you is you just give it like it is. And you saw this shift from ethanol into something else before really anyone else did. And the idea is, look, you mix ethanol with gasoline, but if we're all driving EVs, do you really need the ethanol? How's it going? How's this transition for you going?
It's actually going really well. I mean, thanks for having me again. I love talking to you guys. And, you know, everything that we've laid out so far is on track to get to 2025, which is when we said we're really going to be able to start operating on all cylinders, no pun intended. But look, I think our base fuel still has strong demand, but there's other value that we can unlock in everything that we do. And there's so much technology out there. And we just announced a great collaboration with Shell, a joint venture that we just basically had a grand opening ceremony that really just takes us next level on what we're doing in ag tech, because they, as much as they are one of the largest energy companies in the world, they also have a really interesting view on agriculture and technology, and combining what we can do in energy with what we can do in agriculture. And we've just kicked off an amazing partnership that we've been building for several years. So a lot's going on, and we're really excited about what's happening.
All right, can you talk to us about this joint venture? Because when you mentioned Shell, that gets my attention when I'm thinking about kind of biofuels companies like yourselves kind of getting together with traditional energy companies.
Yeah, so look, what Shell's looking for is more low carbon feedstocks. That's the most important thing to them. And what we're looking for is more low carbon ingredients for food and for feed. And so we have this technology. We bought a company a few years ago, which we think is one of the leading ag tech companies in the world, called FluidQuip Technologies. And they have a separation technology that basically just puts something into their machine and it separates it out into all really interesting ingredients. Shell, on the other hand, had a chemical process that basically unlocks what's left on different parts of agricultural waste or fiber or anything that's getting processed that we couldn't go after to start. And when we put these two together, basically we can combine their chemical process to liberate oils and proteins and other things that are stuck on sugars that are stuck within processes. And then we take it from there and we can separate them all out. So it's really an amazing technology collaboration. We want it so we can get more sugars and proteins. They want it so they can unlock more from the standpoint of vegetable oil, so they can make renewable diesel and other things like that. As well as the last part of it is that we could finally unlock the sugar that's stuck within the fiber, and that's cellulosic sugars. And for years and years and years, people have been trying to crack this code on cellulosic alcohol and fuels, and that dream that people have had. And this is one thing that potentially unlocks that whole dream of getting every piece of value out of every piece of that corn kernel. And it's, and a great thing about this technology is it's just not limited to a single commodity. It's actually agricultural feedstock agnostic. You could drop a lot of different things in this technology. So we think it revolutionizes agricultural processing, if it works, of course. It revolutionizes agricultural processing globally, biorefining globally, unlocks all of the value of what we do in everything from, you know, food and fuel and feed.
Yeah.
And it's the first time, really, we think that a major agricultural company and a, or one of the first times a major agricultural company and a major energy company get together to use everything we do to make all of the different products that we need.
So, Todd, it does sound amazing, and I like the idea of like liberating all the parts of the corn. It's a great phrase. It's a twofold question for me. When you get the stuff from that, what do you use it for? And how expensive is it to sort of ramp and scale all this up?
You know, the great thing is that over the last several years, as we've been transforming our company, we've deployed about $350 million to $400 million in the separation technology already. So we're already using it. So our technology is proven already. So we've put it at several of our facilities and joint venture facilities. So we are already beginning to separate most of what happens in a kernel of corn and other products. So what this does, you lay this over it, and it's all the remaining things that we can't get. They can get it chemically in their processes. We just could never get it that way because that's not what we did as a company. So, you know, the cost, we're hoping because we've already deployed technology at five of our sites, which is six coming on today. When we overlay this technology on top of it, we should be very cost efficient. The first one, we built it under, really, nobody really knew what we were building, but in York, Nebraska, we already have the first build that we've been spending years doing quietly under the radar screen, putting our technologies together. And we're going to start that up in about a month or two. And that's really what we had our grand opening and our announcement on. It was just a very quiet collaboration. But really what it does, it extracts everything available. So all we leave corn oil when we send out our fiber, we can go after that. That can be used in renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel. We leave sugars on our fiber that goes out as animal feed. We can go get that, which can be made into cellulosic second generation low carbon ethanol. There's more protein to go after. We send out very low value protein still. This technology together unlocks ultra high protein that we're already shipping to pet food and salmon producers around the world. It just gives us more, you know. And then lastly, you know, what we're able to do is take all of that and think about low carbon alcohol for things like sustainable aviation fuel that's going to be coming down in the future, because the only true path to volumes of sustainable aviation fuel is going to come through alcohol.
So, and I'm assuming, so if it's cost competitive, if you overlay the technology and it's at cost for you guys, it doesn't raise the price of the product that you're then having to sell?
No, actually, you know, we're just able to unlock more. We're sending it already out as everything left we send out as a more of a lower value product. So it unlocks all of that. And now what we can do is actually make great products and get and much higher values for what we're going to produce than what we're doing today. And the most interesting thing about this technology, Alex, is I can either drop a corn, you know, to the basic of it. I could drop a kernel of corn in there, but I could also drop a soybean in there and blow up and chemically separate that and really disrupt what's happening potentially in soybean processing. Or I can drop a kernel of wheat in there and go unlock all of the protein and the oils and the sugars and all of those things that nobody's been able to go after in any kind of really efficient way.
So Todd, if I'm looking at your stock, it's up 10% almost since that announcement, but it's not had a good full year. And I'm wondering, like, when do you feel like you should be getting credit for this? And I know you're going to say like yesterday, but you know what I'm saying.
Like when we started our transformation, the stock was 8. It ran up into the, you know, the high 30s. Now we're back down. You know, we brought a couple of reasons I think we're down a little bit this year is, well, not a little bit, but, you know, we brought our MLP in. So we wanted to clean up our capital structure. So we were able to bring that in, and we handed our shares to MLP shareholders that, you know, they were earning a pretty high yield. And I think that put some pressure on our stock, as well as we've seen some drops in prices, and in ethanol is trading $1 under gas. So now we're getting more competitive again. But we really saw a drop in vegetable oil pricing here recently, but now that's starting to come back, which I think is putting a bid back into our stock as well. So, you know, we're about a year, you know, what you've said is we're our path to 2025, 24 is our transition year. We need to deliver on some financial results this year. And I think we're going to be able to do that as the year progresses. But, you know, we've made investments and, you know, the whole sector really kind of fell out of favor anyways. And I think we got dragged down with that. But we have a great technology. We have a great platform. We've got great products. We're going to start our first, and I know we talked about this a few years ago, our first clean sugar facility. We're going to make food grade dextrose for everything from gummy bears to seltzer drinks. That's never happened in the history of our industry. We're starting that up next month and later this month as well. So there's a lot going on. We're right towards the back end of what we said we were going to do. And now it's starting to all come to fruition, you know, and the pressure came across the whole sector. If you look across the whole sector in agricultural processing.
You finally said the word that got John Tucker here in the studio excited. You said gummy bears. And all of a sudden he perks up.
I got distracted. I'm sorry. But, you know.
Ethanol, whatevs, okay.
This liberating is like oil corn, in those gummy bears?
Fine, but, you know, gummy bears. No, sugar. He was paying attention. Hey, Todd, really appreciate it. Always good to catch up with you. Todd Becker, President and CEO of Green Plains, joining us from...
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Nebraska.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
So every day, Bloomberg has a big take where they really dive deep into a topic and a story, and they're quite good. And there's a podcast, and it's a written piece, and I highly recommend that you check it out. And the one today is particularly interesting. The title, Hubris at Hertz, doomed its massive bet on 100,000 Teslas. It's basically the rise and fall over the last few years of Hertz and its relationship with Tesla and EVs. Eric Schatzker and David Welch responsible for this article. We have Eric Schatzker, who is now Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director, joining us. It was a great piece. And there were things about Teslas that, like, I didn't know were problems. Like, if you don't know how to drive it and you all of a sudden put the pedal to the metal, you go really fast and then you crash. Like these little details I found so interesting. Walk us through what you learned and what the piece is about.
Well, you just touched on one of those things, Alex, which is that the experience of a Tesla owner is very different from the experience of a Tesla renter. And going into this big bet on 100,000 Teslas, they placed an order for 100,000 Teslas, in fact, back in 2021. The new owners at Hertz didn't appreciate that. There were no data, to be fair, on what it was like for a rental car company to have EVs in the fleet, mm-hmm. because none did. Hertz was going to be the first. And so they did look at the data. How do Teslas perform when they're owned by individuals? And generally speaking, Teslas perform well. They don't require a lot of maintenance. Obviously, refueling the car, so to speak, is a matter of plugging it in. But if it's your Tesla, it probably sits in your garage or it sits in your driveway. Or maybe if you live in a city like New York, it's at a parking garage and you've had a charger put in. That's all fine, and these people tend not to get into a lot of accidents, and they don't have range anxiety because they own the car. They made the decision to buy it. It's a totally different story. When you get off of a red-eye flight and, you know, stroll up to the Hertz counter and are told that, no, I'm sorry, the car you reserved is not available, but we're giving you a Tesla. If you've never been behind the wheel of an EV, it can be a terrifying experience. You don't know. You don't want to have to find a charger in the wild. You don't know what this instantaneous braking is like.
You don't know how to turn on the car.
You don't realize that it has rocket-like acceleration. And as a result, Hertz, with its Tesla fleet, started running into all kinds of problems. They were crashing, and it's very expensive to repair a Tesla. In many cases, they have to be junked because insurance companies are worried about the damage that might have occurred to the battery. People didn't want to rent them, so the demand wasn't there. And then, of course, Elon Musk cut Tesla prices by 30% and kind of blew a hole into Hertz's balance sheet.
How did Hertz get into this position?
It's a good question. This was a rental car company, the only major rental car company that went bankrupt. In the early days of the pandemic.
I'm a Gold Circle member of Hertz, by the way. I just stroll right up to my car, John.
Some people have very good experiences with Hertz, including Paul Sweeney, evidently. So Hertz went bankrupt. It was bought out of bankruptcy in June 2021 by two professional investors. Tom Wagner runs Knighthead Capital, and Greg O'Hara is the founding partner at Certares Management. They raised $1.5 billion fund. They wanted to find travel and leisure companies that had been crushed by the pandemic, but of course, which in theory would soar once the economy reopened, and Hertz seemed like a great candidate. And actually that part of the thesis played out perfectly. Once the economy reopened, in fact, before the economy reopened, when people realized getting into a car and driving somewhere doesn't put me at risk of COVID at all, demand for rentals went sky high. And so coming out of this acquisition from bankruptcy, Hertz was crushing it, but they had a transformational plan to turn it into a largely electrified rental car company. And that's where everything went pear-shaped. I talked about it, the demand, the damage, the price cuts. And we say it's a tale of hubris because in many respects, it is. Of course, everything looks clear in hindsight. It did sound like an incredibly good idea at the time. And I think for the sake of the planet, it would be nice if you could electrify a rental car company and save, you know, the environment from all the gasoline that gets poured into rental cars. But it just doesn't work in practice. And whether it's arrogance, whether it's hubris, whether it's blind optimism, it could be a combination of all those three. These new owners, these professional investors, one who runs a hedge fund, the other who runs a private equity firm, thought that they had an answer for this industry that the industry itself had ignored for years. And the truth of the matter is running any company in any industry is tough, right? Requires some experience, maybe.
And the funny thing is, well, not for them, but is that they could be right, just either a little early or a little late, depending on how you look at it. Like making,
you know, whenever we talk about early, right,
it's
the broken clock thing, right? Broken clock is right two times a day. And in the case of being early,
I thought it was a great strategy when I first heard
it.
It hit so many buttons there. But I guess it kind of goes to the bigger question, which we asked the auto industry writ large, is have we seen peak interest in EVs?
But this is why I found the article so interesting, because there were things that I didn't think about in that they don't have dealerships, right?
No.
So they don't have a relationship with dealerships. So like when my Subaru tire gets, you know, messed up, we just drive it in and then they fix it and then we drive out kind of thing. You can't do that with a Tesla. I never thought of that, for example. I never thought of how difficult it would be to all of a sudden get off a plane and go sit in a Tesla. It's weird enough getting in the morning to a Tesla and getting in the back seat. I can't imagine just being shoved into the front seat and having to drive it at the same time. And these little details I found to be very provocative.
Well, they are, as you say, something of an indication as to why demand for EVs right now is slowing. Hertz, you know, we can play on the fact that it even has yellow as part of its logo, was the canary in the coal mine for the EV industry.
What began
to happen at Hertz is what the rest of the industry is beginning to wake up to, that all of the EVs that are being cranked out right now may not have a natural buyer because people aren't enough chargers out there. People haven't gotten over this idea that it's a different driving experience. Mm. People, as we all know, are very personal about their cars, right? It's an extension of themselves, and you don't want your arm to feel like it doesn't belong on your body. And that's, in some respects, how people feel about getting behind the wheel of an EV.
30 seconds left, Eric. If I wanted a Tesla from Hertz tomorrow, could I get one? Or are they just...
You can. They are beginning to sell down the fleet, though. They had 60,000 EVs. They've put about 20,000 Teslas on the market. In fact, if you want to buy a Tesla, now is a great time to buy one used. In fact, even off the Hertz website, because they are...
They're like
way cheaper than they've ever been before.
All right. I tell you, folks, this is great stuff. Big Take stories, we love them. We love to support the Big Take reporting because it is deep, really cool stories and really cool, well-researched, well-sourced articles. You can read the Big Take stuff, Eric's story today, on all the Big Take stories on the terminal. Plus, you can go to Bloomberg.com/Big Take and get access there. Eric Schatzker, Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director. We appreciate getting you into Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm going to talk technology. I got a lot of things on the plate here technology-wise. Anurag Rana joins us, Senior Technology Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio in New York City because Bloomberg Intelligence is hosting an AI seminar conference, Bloomberg headquarters this afternoon. Is that right?
Yeah, 12:30 onwards. A lot of companies, Google, Microsoft, Salesforce, Adobe. Oh. I mean, we have
And lots of smart investors are going to be there, right?
Lots of smart investors.
All right, cool.
Okay, so I'm ordering a panel, and you said that I could ask dumb questions, though. Is that still hold?
No, you're gonna do really well.
Okay,
I'm sure.
Because I'm like, I'm serious. I'm no AI expert here.
All right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start with this story, this hubbub thing. What is HubSpot? And it's a $30 billion market cap company.
Yeah.
Can't be acquired. They're too big for.
Exactly my point. Because they see from a market share point of view.
Let's summarize the story here because I just went right over.
It's a CRM software company, HubSpot. They primarily sell to small and medium businesses. It's a high growth company. It's done very well. It is, it is one of the favorite stocks for people. I mean, a growth stock.
Today is that Alphabet, this is a Reuters reporting that Alphabet is, I think Bloomberg's matched it. Alphabet's perhaps is in talks to acquire this company. And again, this company has a market cap of $34 billion, which automatically means regulators aren't going to allow it.
That's my biggest thing. See, okay. One of the things is Google does not play a lot into the enterprise applications world, which is Salesforce, Workday, Microsoft. You know, Google has some Google Sheets and a few other products, but it's really not a big player in the cloud applications area as much as, you know, somebody like a Salesforce would do. But this could be a big deal. I mean, if it happens, it, you know, completely shakes up the competitive landscape. But as Paul mentioned, I mean, it's going to be tough for regulators to approve anything that big.
Yeah, exactly. But then there are so many software companies, at some point, they're going to have to do some some M&A, right? There's like a bazillion of them. I honestly can't keep them straight.
No, I agree with everything that you're saying, but the question is who the buyer is going to be.
Right.
The problem in this case or in a lot of these cases is regulators are very tough on large, you know, of the big tech giants buying software or any company that much.
How are they going to feel about Apple and robots? So here's the story. So this broke when I was on TV yesterday. So this is Mark Gurman broke the story that Apple apparently has teams investigating a push into personal robotics. And that's a field with the potential to become one of the company's ever-shifting, quote, next big things. This is according to people familiar with the situation. They were looking at, say, robots that can follow users around their home, for example. Exactly. And they have also deployed an advanced tabletop home device that uses robotics to move a display around. What does this mean?
At the CES, Samsung showed a demo of a robot that's following around and, you know, you're working out and all sorts of stuff. So these things don't really move the needle. It's a fancy stuff to be part of the, you know, Apple ecosystem. But, you know, frankly, I mean, how many can you sell and how much money can you make? So I'm you know, doesn't get me excited, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think so as we think about Apple, it seems to me the next big thing, to use that term, has got to be you have to give shareholders and AI play.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And if, and perhaps it will occur as soon as their developer conference in June.
Yeah.
What do you think, whether it's this year or next, what do you think a viable AI play is for Apple?
Think about it, that our phone is a medium for do anything. If I give you, right now, if I have to, let's say, ask a question to OpenAI, I open the phone, go into the OpenAI app, and write my query. Imagine you don't have to do any of that stuff. You straight away ask Siri that question and you get a very good answer. Right now, the answers aren't very good. So that's the step that if they can figure out that algorithm in between, I think it's going to do them very well.
Did they figure it out or do they work with Google and stuff or Microsoft to figure it out?
That's a very good question. And, you know, Mark had reported that if they work with, in my view, if they work with Google, I think it's going to be much faster. I think if they work with OpenAI, same, it's going to be faster. Just because we've only heard that they got rid of the car division a few months ago, reallocated some engineers there. You know, if they had something, they would have deployed it, you know, or would have showcased it. So if they're working very hard to come up with a new product, you're not going to just come up within 2-3 months mm-hmm. and be ready for it. So I hope for their sake, for their stock, that they do announce a partnership with one of those two companies and showcase people what capabilities can be there. Now, remember, in the case of Microsoft, when they have a deal with OpenAI, their products have enhanced very quickly using OpenAI's, you know, backbone or technology, whether it's, you know, Office or whether it's GitHub, the coding platform. It's been very quick. So it can be done, but you know, we'll find out in June.
The stock's down 11% this year. It lends me to believe that, you know, the marginal hedge fund buyer is not going in there buying a position ahead of this June event. Is that, I mean, what are you hearing out there? Do people think we'll get something this June or not?
Apple has always been more of a value play for a long while. In between, it became a growth story because during the pandemic, there was a lot of games downloaded. And, you know, so now that growth phase is over. Now we're getting back to that single digit growth rate. I always thought they had maybe a high single digit number, but this year it's going to be low single digit to even flat. You know, so it's going to be bad this year only because of China. But having said that, this is a company that can grow, you know, revenue 5-6% in a normal year.
So this is why the robot thing, if we circle back to that, confused me. Because why would they put anybody into something like that? Why wouldn't they just take those workers and put them into an AI segment to work on that instead? Like, why?
It could be somebody's pet project. I mean, it's just, these are such
literally.
They can afford to do it all, yeah. I would argue.
Okay, well, fair enough. Are they going to do a big buyback?
They have been spending almost $90 billion a year for buybacks. I've been hoping
more.
They will do a little more, but that's not the case because they do have to showcase whether they really can fix the China situation or not, because I don't think buybacks would help that unless we have some clarity on China or AI.
On China, since you're bringing up China, how do we get clarity on China? Because right now, if I were a shareholder, I would feel like that is by far the biggest headwind to this company.
It has been, and you know, we've talked about it for the last 2 years. He just went to China.
Yep.
He's been, you know, and basically telling everybody how China is very good for them and they'll invest more money. Maybe that changes the behavior over the next few months, because so far what we have seen in the last 2 quarters is They've been losing market share, and people are opting for a local brand rather than the Apple brand. And I think Apple's cachet, you know, should come back if they are able to convince that China is an integral part of their story. I think it can turn around.
Well, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen there now, so see how that sort of pairs out. Before we let you go, also the FT had an interesting article that talked about Google considering charging for AI-powered search. What would that in essence mean? And that's a big deal for Google to do something along those lines, so, right?
See, once again, OpenAI, when you get the app, you get the free app, which everybody. If you want GPT-4, which is the latest version of their you know, AI model, you have to pay a subscription. I think it's $19.99 a month or $20 a month. It's probably going to be the same thing for, you know, Google or anybody else out there, that you have a base level model that's free, and then you can, you know, charge a little bit more for a premium model. It's just part of, you know, how they want to monetize some
but
of that
what
stuff.
What I find interesting, Paul, I don't know if you noticed this, but when I search for something on Google now on my phone, I don't click any of the links anymore, because all of a sudden you can click on a drop down menu and it gives you a quote from the page you would have clicked on. And I have to think, like, does Google lose money there? Is that or the other companies, like, how does that affect them?
See, Google controls the search market, and they have a little bit of a threat in front of them. I personally think they will figure out, but the two demos that they have done in the last 1 year have not really worked out well for them. But I feel they will figure it out.
All right, Anurag Rana, thank you so much. He's in town. Again, the Bloomberg Intelligence folks, they're hosting a big conference here in our New York headquarters at 731 Lex about all things AI. I think they've got the definitive research report out there, deep dive on AI, and they're going to get some of the industry leaders coming to the Bloomberg headquarters today, giving us the latest on what has really been the driving force, not just in technology, but really across the markets over the last 18 months or so. So that's going to be cool this afternoon. Anurag Rana, thank you so much.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Appreciate that.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, folks, on this week's episode of The Deal, Jason Kelly and former baseball star Alex Rodriguez, they talk with RedBird Capital founder and managing partner Jerry Cardinale. He breaks down his career, the purchase of AC Milan, and so much more. He also discusses how sports investing has evolved over time. Take a listen.
And so I guess I had a very philosophical moment where I said, you know, what gets me up in the morning? What do I love? And I love playing shadow entrepreneur, and I like solving problems with capital. And you know, it just so happens, you know, luck in people's career, I happen to hit an inflection point with sports that I couldn't possibly have seen coming. Back in 2001, right? You look back on that, the last 20 years, and you're like, wow, you really, luck's great. You really hit an air pocket that, you know, where you took off. Now the challenge is navigating that, because now everybody's discovered sports.
Yeah.
Sports is now an asset class. That scares me. When I start to hear about things like sports being an asset class, my initial reaction is to run in the other way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but I say, look, you can't make money if you don't put money to work.
All right. That's Jerry Cardinale. He is the RedBird Capital founder and managing partner. I'm a big fan of his. He's really a leading financier in the world of sports, entertainment, media, the convergence of all that kind of good stuff. And he sat down with Jason Kelly and Alex Rodriguez for their Big Take podcast. Jason Kelly joins us here. He's chief correspondent for Bloomberg Originals. Jason is also host and executive producer of The Deal podcast. Jason, really cool discussion with Jerry Cardinale. He's involved in so much. What would you guys talk about?
Yeah, I mean, it was the biggest challenge with Jerry was sort of
narrowing it down in a lot of ways. I mean, to me, the two most interesting things about him at the moment, and there is more than this, you know, one was the very instrumental role he played with the Yankees yep. at a pivotal time in that franchise, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, especially, you know, right in your wheelhouse, the creation of the Yes Network, which obviously just set sort of a different path for media rights and how teams and leagues, you know, sort of deal with all of that. So that's one. And then the second is moving into ownership in a meaningful way with AC Milan, you know, one of the most storied soccer clubs in the world, and sort of what led him there. And then along the way, he's doing business with Tom Cruise and Top Gun Maverick, and he's in business with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, and he's in business with The Rock and Danny Garcia and the XFL. So he's got his hands on a lot.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. So what's next? Like, what else is he working on?
I mean,
does he sleep?
I don't know how he does it, because I mean, he really is he's a globe-trotting dealmaker. You know, I mean, you know, one of the things he identified, I think, along with a lot of folks, was, you know, the importance of sovereign wealth. So he's in business with Abu Dhabi, looking at a number of different things. Jeff Zucker, you know, the former CNN executive, is a partner of his, looking at media deals. They took a look at the Telegraph over in the UK. They're involved in Skydance, you know, which obviously is in the headlines today, with the Paramount deal. So a lot going on for him, clearly. And as he said, as you heard him say in that clip, you know, part of it was luck. I mean, he was at Goldman and, you know, saw some things happening with the sports world. Clearly, the Yankees were a local client. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but they were. Yep. But, you know, he clearly anticipated a lot of this collision, this coalescing, as it were, of business, sports, technology, media, et cetera.
One of the things we've all seen over the last, you know, many years is just the continued increase in the value of sports,
yeah.
whether it's the franchises themselves in the various sports globally or the rights fees
yep.
for the broadcasting. What's his view on that? Because it seems like you just can't lose money in this kind of stuff.
I mean, that's always the dangerous place to be, right? You
yeah.
know, when it feels like that, which it certainly does. You're exactly right, Paul. That's exactly how it feels right now. You know, I mean, and this, again, gets into a lot of your expertise around the media world. I mean, part of what is fueling that is this massive disruption in media between, you know, broadcast, cable, streamers. Who's going to really pay up for the media rights for the big sports
yep.
and even some of the smaller sports? We don't know. I mean, when this new NBA deal comes up, one of the big speculations is Netflix going to be in that? Is Amazon going to be in that? Or is it going to be some of the more traditional players? That flows straight through to valuations, as you alluded to. And, you know, you're seeing, you know, these teams just trade up and up and up. The Washington Commanders going for $6 billion. The Phoenix Suns going for $4 billion. I mean, these are eye-popping, mind-blowing numbers for franchises that 20 years ago were selling for like a couple hundred million dollars.
So why did he freak out when he said sports is an asset class?
I think...
freak out is an overstatement. But,
yeah.
you know, like why does that worry him then? When, like, he's part of making it an asset class.
I think because it has the danger of becoming sort of commodified and, you know,
yeah.
traded in a way that, you know, maybe takes out some of the opportunities to find opportunities, if that makes sense. He had this one line that I love that we've been talking about in our production team, which is they try and arbitrage incompetence, which I think is one of the like funniest things. And like,
where else can we do that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, do you want to make a list?
Okay.
You want to make a list right now?
Okay.
let's create a shared note, you and me. Because I just love that idea. I mean, as an investor, I mean, that is actually what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to find these opportunities where it's like, they're not running it right. Let's go in and run it better.
So how does Alex, in these conversations, I would think Alex is, in most of these, kind of an insider. He knows all these people. He's probably seen a lot of the deals that they've seen.
Well,
he knows
this
the
one,
same people.
Oh, totally. You're totally right, Paul. I mean, this one was fascinating because, you know, this is a guy who actually was instrumental, Jerry, in helping bring Alex to New York, which is, you know, one of the biggest
yep.
deals that happens for the Yankees in the last 25 years, as you well know. You know, the other thing they talked about was, you know, getting together over dinner with Randy Levine, the president of the Yankees, and saying, hold on, how do we put together a roster that can actually win us a championship? And guess what? They did. Mm-hmm. 2009. Yep. I mean, they were, the three of them, instrumental in identifying who could make that happen. So you're right. I mean, it's very fun. I fully confess, for me to sit here and be like, no, you guys just tell this story. What was happening sort of behind the scenes and around that table?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I can imagine that, like, you feel successful if you don't have to talk.
Yeah.
And they can just, like, exactly. Go at it, because that's, it's like, how I would do it.
Say more about that. Yeah. That's my contribution.
Yeah, exactly. Tell me how you felt about
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
What else can we look forward to? What's next on your plate?
So a couple really good episodes, you know, still to come. We're about halfway through the season. Brandi Chastain is one I'm especially excited people to listen to. Of course, iconic player. And last week we were down in Miami filming an episode with none other than the GOAT herself, Serena Williams. So
wow.
That's coming up in a few weeks.
This is why you have sun on your face.
Yes.
So for a radio audience, I was like, why is he sort of tan?
It's been nothing
He's
but
like
raining
sunny.
Over.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Totally. How does this guy pull it off? Yeah. So I can't wait for y'all to listen to Serena. She is unbelievable. It's stories and perspectives from her that you've never heard before. So very, very excited for that one down the line.
Okay, awesome stuff. Jason Kelly, chief correspondent for Bloomberg Originals. He's also a host and executive producer of The Deal. And on this week's episode of The Deal, Jason Kelly and Alex Rodriguez, they talk with Redbird Capital founder and managing partner Jerry Cardinale. Jerry, he's going to break down his career, the purchase of AC Milan. They own that one, a storied franchise in Serie A in Italy, and so much more. He also discusses how sports investing has evolved over time. So some good stuff there. We'll have that. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.